Hey guys, just a brief note up top about the Crack Podcast and all podcasts for that matter. A lot of people out there don't understand podcasts. They don't understand why they're fun. If my friends and relatives are any indication, they don't understand how to listen to them. Anyways, we're asking you to help us change that. Think of a friend, a family member, anyone you care about or just don't hate, and ask yourself what podcast they'd be into, whether it's a show you think they'd think is funny, informative, gripping, or all three. Cracked Podcast. We're asking you to just tell them about podcasts. So this month, take a couple minutes to explain podcasts to someone in need of an explanation of podcasts. And if you're using social media, use the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag T-R-Y pod. Thanks, and on to the show. After this other ad from Squarespace. Today's episode of the Crack Podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Whether you are starting a new business or launching a creative project, you can count on Squarespace to help you create an eye-catching and professional website that stands out from the rest. Let's say eye-seducing instead of eye-catching. Eye-catching always makes me think of someone's eye getting caught on something, and that is not what Squarespace will do. With Squarespace's beautifully designed templates and customizable features, you'll have everything you need, be it a landing page, a gallery, a professional blog to make your next move. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED to get 10% off your first purchase, plus a free domain. Squarespace, make your next move. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked. And before we get into it, just a reminder that the next live episode of the Cracked Podcast is this Saturday, March 11th at 7 p.m. That's this Saturday. If you are listening to this episode the week it drops, we're going to be asking what fictional location you would visit and what you'd do there if you had the chance. Would you do a scavenger hunt in Gotham, some sex tourism in Cabot Cove from Murder, She Wrote? Probably neither of those. For some good answers to that question, come see me this Saturday when I'll be joined by our hilarious special guest co-host, Daniel Van Kirk, who you may know as Mark Wahlberg on Doug Loves Movies. And we're going to have guests including Josh Androsky, Allison Stevenson, Eric Lampere, the hilarious Jamie Loftus from the rom-com episode earlier this year, and Alan Strickland Williams. So tickets are $7. Links to purchase them will be in the summary and on our website. All right, this week we're listening to our generic bonus episode music because I'm gonna retire my musical selections for the time being. Perhaps get an actual theme song like a real boy, because I just end up spending too much time on the music selections that I'd rather put into the content of the show. So here we are. Thanks to all the people who loved the music. I'll continue to share what I'm listening to on Twitter. You can follow me at Jack_O'Brien if you like. Sorry, a lot of housekeeping up top. This week's subject is movie tropes that happen every time a movie has to depict a certain situation that, when you really think about it, have never happened in the recorded history of ever. For instance, I've never witnessed someone run to stop someone at the gate of the plane they're leaving on and profess their love. It's so common in movies and TV shows that we expect it. When Minnie Driver gets on a plane in Good Will Hunting, she actually looks around for Will because the filmmakers know that's what we're expecting to happen. And if you tried to run past security in reality, you'd get shot a bunch of times. In movies, it's so common the movie has to acknowledge that we know what you're expecting, but plot twist, we're not doing that for once. Movies also have their own laws of physics that they've all agreed make it possible to body surf on an explosion. unless it's in the same car as them, or they're in the process, or just got done swallowing it, an exploding object will interact with a human body like a strong and sudden gust of wind in movies, whereas real explosions cause the human body to experience what's known in the world of pretty gross-looking ways to die as total body disruption. Also, the casing and every solid object between you and the bomb gets turned into a million tiny little bullets. Anyways, this is one of those intros, as you can probably tell, where I just Rolodex a bunch of examples I didn't have a chance to get to in the episode, so you get your money's worth. We'll also talk about stuff we're just tired of movies doing, kinda. One I didn't get to that filmmakers can feel free to never do again is the scene where the bad guy has a gun pointed at the protagonist, and like we do a reverse shot on the protagonist preparing for death, and we hear a bang, and then there's like a pause and then a wide shot, and the bad guy falls down because someone from off screen came in and surprise shot them. That's not surprising anymore, assholes. Some of the tropes we'll be talking about today aren't just annoyances. They actually do some harm. Like at the end of Independence Day, when they're showing the alien ships kind of self-destructing in the sky around the world, they show us all the continents. America, we see a military base. Australia, we see Sydney and its weird architecture. And for Africa, we see guys in loincloths shaking spears at the sky. Now, real Africa is full of cities with developed cultures, complex economies, some that are more advanced technologically than the most advanced in our country. Their version of mobile payments is going to be the future of how we'll use money. But you never see any of that shit in movies. Casino Royale opens in Africa with a bunch of dudes betting on a snake fighting a mongoose. Congo, Blood Diamond, Hotel Rwanda, that Nicolas Cage movie about a gun runner. I think it's called Lord of War or God of War or something. I don't think you see a single modern building in any of those movies. But the Africans in those movies sure have figured out how to attach a rocket launcher to the side of a truck. And that's just absurd. Imagine if every movie about America took place in Alaska and focused on gang wars between the Bloods and Crips. That's how Africans probably feel about Hollywood's choice to exclusively portray their enormous continent as only warlords fighting in the desert. There's actually another really fucked up one I want to tell you about, but this intro is getting long, so let's get into the episode. I'll be back at the end to dig into that fucked up example and some footnotes. Talk to you then.
I won't have headphones, so you'll have to tell me if I say anything racist, because I won't know.
That's the only way you can tell. I guess we're recording now, and I want to use that joke. So we're joined by Soren Bowie, Daniel O'Brien, and Carmen Angelica. How's it going, guys?
Good.
It's going all right. Happy Lent, everybody.
So today we're talking about movie tropes, because there was a recent obsessive pop culture disorder that I really loved, Daniel.
Oh, weird.
I was taken aback. Usually hate the show.
Yeah.
Dug in for a real hate watch and really, really enjoyed myself. And it was about movie tropes that kind of don't correspond to reality.
Yeah, it was movie tropes that I know why we do them, why we as in movie makers do them. I'm just sick of seeing them because they have no basis in reality. And it's just the kind of thing that like the first screenwriter, they're all ideas where I feel like the first screenwriter who came up with it, that was a good idea
sure.
to efficiently get information across. And then everyone who's covered it after has been a tremendous hack.
Yes.
But one of them that persisted, that really bothered me was plot moving forward in the beginning because the man walks in on his wife or girlfriend cheating on him. And it's usually like in a weird way, like in old school, she's cheating on him with two blindfolded people. Right. Or it's in like an aggressively shitty way, like in This Is Where I Leave You, he walks in on his wife cheating on him with his like shitty douchebag boss. Because it's, what's the quickest way that we can say, A, this man needs to go on a new journey now and find himself, and B, no sympathy is due for the wife at all.
Right.
No, like we don't need to question why this marriage is ending, why she would need to cheat on him or want to cheat on him, because She either has weird sex or sex with horrible people. So put her out of your minds, everybody. It's fine.
Yeah. Came Polly, you didn't even mention. And I couldn't believe it. But that movie starts with him on his honeymoon and his wife having sex with Hank Azaria.
Hank Azaria.
Yeah. Scuba instructor Hank Azaria.
Hank Azaria is actually, I feel like, that guy in a lot of films.
Yeah.
Like, he was in
America's Sweetheart.
America's Sweetheart, yeah. Mm. He's the guy.
Oh, yeah, Catherine Zeta-Jones leaves John Cusack for Hank Azaria.
Yeah.
Because he's good at sex, right? And, like, a massage therapist or something?
I think it's implied, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the 90s, so he's vaguely foreign in that way that is like, ooh, exotic, they have better sex than John Cusack, I think was the message of that movie.
Murray the Dog and Mad About You.
Yeah.
Constantly hanging out with him instead of Paul and Helen.
Yeah. But yeah, I just got bored by that trope. It didn't ring true to me, especially because if you look into any statistics, most infidelity-related divorces are the fault of the men, and I didn't want to get like too high horse about it because obsessive pop culture disorder is like a bullshit show where I talk about things in movies that I don't like. But me, the real person, wants to reach out to movies and say, hey, if you're going to use the hook of your movie, person gets cheated on and then needs to change their life in some drastic way, we have a closer real world analog that you're completely ignoring, because it's really rare for a movie's forward thrust to be caused by a woman walking in on her husband cheating on her with someone shitty. I'm sure there's a few times that it happens in movies, but it's so much more common in real life, and the reverse is so much more common in movies.
I'm trying to think of how you get through that first scene. If you're a guy and you're writing a screenplay about a guy who's now got to go, like, change his life around after being married, I'm trying to think of, like, a more elegant way of getting him to out of a relationship.
Catch a
other than like
message,
murdering
like,
her.
Well, it would be efficient if he like caught a text message or something along those lines. But yeah, it's just the thing that I was struck by is that they've shot the exact same scene over and over and over. It's like the guy walking in. The most recent example was a show I watched last week, the new Pete Holmes show on HBO. The inciting incident for that entire show is he walks in.
That's based on reality, I think.
But I know that his wife and he ended up getting a divorce because she was having an affair, but I don't think he like walked in on her. I think they were just like, well, this is a movie, so you have to walk in while she's actively having sex with a stranger.
Guy so wacky. Leaf.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. guy who's like really like willing to look you in the eye and be like, hey, bro, it's cool. Like I'm having sex with your wife. Yeah.
And also, if you want a story that's going to be about a guy making a sharp left turn in his life and either changing his life in a dramatic fashion or taking some new initiative somewhere, it doesn't necessarily need to have anything to do with a cheating spouse. I mean, if the rest of the plot of Old School was in any way relevant to Juliette Lewis, then sure, you want this marriage thing to be part of like the plot, but it's not. He gets divorced and then starts a fucking fraternity and immediately starts sleeping around and falling in love with another woman. Like, we didn't even take an opportunity to answer the question, does he have trust issues now? No, he doesn't. He sleeps with children and falls in love with
high school girl.
So they don't. The fact that he was cheated on doesn't have any impact on the plot. So if you want a movie where like guy has a sudden change of life, I don't know. Find out that your mom was actually your sister this whole time, or the person you thought was, or your dad had a whole separate family, or you found out that the company that you were working for is like a Nazi company. It's like, oh gosh, I gotta all of what I thought about myself and my life are different, so now I have to do something else. They're like, these are all hit reasons.
Let me just say I agree with you. You're right.
Oh, thank you.
Dynamite dropping, Soren. Yeah, it feels like they want to establish sympathy, I guess, because otherwise in Old School their behavior would be deplorable. Seen as deplorable, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but that's not a good enough reason, probably,
to
sleep with high school students.
When Old School came out, I really enjoyed it the same way that everybody else who was my age probably did. But now that I'm older, I think there's a much more interesting version of that movie where you keep all of the same beats. Like, he gets cheated on by his wife and starts a fraternity. And it's not like him reconnecting with his friends and finding out who he really was inside, because apparently the guy who married his wife was some loser version of himself, and now this is the cool one. Play it for what it would be. If Soren, if your wife left you and you started a fraternity, I'd be like, holy shit, Soren's life is falling apart.
He is spiraling.
This is, like that's an interesting movie to me now as a 31-year-old is like, what the fuck are you doing, man? Like, the Vince Vaughn character would be like, no, I'm not going to help you build a fraternity. You drinking constantly with children is not the solution to your divorce.
This sounds like you're going to redo this, but as a drama. Serious.
Coming this summer, old school.
Listen, Luke Wilson, hold on a second. Earmuffs, you are spiraling out of control and you need some serious help. This is bad for you. I'm worried.
Yeah, a similar one that I think happens in that same movie is the openly bad boyfriend who loves bragging about cheating on his girlfriend to strangers. I've never met.
That's
one
how
of
we
those.
Find out that they're bad. Yeah, right. The wedding singer.
Man, I could
wedding
tag
crashers.
Some tail like that, bro. He's like, I just met you, and I'm better friends with your girlfriend.
Bro code, man.
Right, bro code.
Wedding singer is a really egregious one for me. Whatever her crummy fiance is. I mean, to begin with, you never even that's Glenn. Another trope. Why is sweet Drew Barrymore with Glenn? Why are these people together? They have no chemistry. He's like shitty even before he cheats. But just so the audience is on Adam Sandler's side, as if there's anyone who came to the wedding singer that was like, I bet there's shades of gray. We're already on Adam Sandler's side. But just in case, let's have Glenn talk to Adam Sandler and say, I've been having sex outside of my relationship last week with hotter women, and I'm going to continue doing that when I'm married. I know this is the second time we've met, but right. You seem like someone who would do nothing with this information.
But you seem really close to my fiance, so it seems like you're trustworthy.
They go out of their way to make as much as the woman who cheats on the husband, they go out of their way to make it very egregious that this man is bad. And it turns out you don't need to do that in movies at all, that no one gives a shit if the woman just leaves the guy because you prefer she would be with somebody else. Like, Liar Liar, he's great, man.
Really sweet.
Other than that he can't do the claw, he's such a nice, honest dude. And he's like, he's really stable. And at the end, you're like, yeah, fuck you, man. I don't care.
He was going to co-raise this child, which is like a very hard thing to do. It's a very noble thing to do. There's so much commitment to just be like, yeah, I'm not this kid's father, but I'm prepared to raise him as a stepdad.
Because I love his mom.
Because I love his mom so much. And it's like, oh, but Jim Carrey learned the lesson that lying is bad.
Jim Carrey is so much bigger. more fun.
I just want to see, we follow this guy with, apparently he's telling every guy about how he cheats. Yeah. It's just like him, going to the coffee place and being like, by the way, cheat a bunch. They're like, double latte.
Do you want that on the cup?
Put it on the cup. Loved in. Because we, the audience in Wedding Crashers, knew that Bradley Cooper was cheating on Rachel McAdams. Mm-hmm. We also didn't need that because we already hated him. But he says it into his phone to one of his buddies that he's having sex with someone else. And the movie was like, no, this isn't enough. Owen Wilson needs to know, too. So the scene is Bradley Cooper and his friends kick Owen Wilson out of a restaurant. Bradley Cooper punches the shit out of him while he's being held back. And then while Owen Wilson is lying on the ground, puts his jacket on and is like, all right, I'm going to go fuck somebody who's not Rachel McAdams now, and, walks away.
Yeah, that's true.
Got it. Okay,
he didn't
good.
Just
he's
cheat
bad.
Once.
Do you think they find it more egregious that these guys tell people? Like, that they're doing it, he's doing it, he's telling his friends, but that they would tell,
That's a really good point, because I was rereading Chuck Klosterman's book, I Wear the Black Hat, that's all about, cultural villains, mm-hmm. and he was saying that the reason that people hated Wilt Chamberlain and loved Bill Clinton was because Bill Clinton never spoke about the Lewinsky affair. He kind of just kept his mouth shut about it, whereas Wilt Chamberlain openly bragged about how many women he slept with. And there's an inbuilt code that we will not trust a guy who will talk about sleeping with people.
Interesting. Mm.
So I think that might be it. We do need that. Because if he's demure about it and respectful about the affairs he's having, we're like, oh, he seems like a good guy.
Yeah, he's trying.
He also, by the way, in the Wedding Crashers thing, as if that's not enough that he's like, yeah, dude, we tagged those two girls. It was sweet. He calls a guy a WAP genius.
Yeah.
He has old-fashioned 1920s racism thrown in. It's what?
I think maybe they were in the scripting stage, they were like, we have to make sure that this works because that character is so rarely played by an actual actor. And then in this case, they got Bradley Cooper, who was every single thing he did. He put on a bunch of weight for the role.
He was so good.
And he's football stuff, that's all him. I mean, that's what he's bringing to it. So you can create a really smarmy personality without the dialogue, but then the dialogue was also over the top, so it's just what are we doing here?
I forgot one more thing that he did when he was talking to one of his buddies. And they're like, so you're going to marry Claire, right? That's going to be good. Yeah, I mean, once I marry her, she better stop having her job, stop trying to save the world bullshit, and just be my wife.
Oh, yeah,
his
right.
friend is like, ha, yes. Oh, good.
The irony, though, in my best friend's wedding, the guy that our main girl is in love with, he wants the same, his wife to do the same thing, but he's like the love interest. He wants Cameron Diaz to like, he's like, she's going to quit school. She's
really?
Gonna, yeah. She's not going to do, like, she's not going to continue.
Oh,
and
that's
he gets
right.
like really mad at her for it.
Yeah.
And that's like treated as an actual conflict. Well, obviously, he wants her to quit school.
Yeah.
And she doesn't want to. Crazy girl. When will these two kids ever figure it out?
These are, again, I don't know why I have to keep doing like pop-ups to clarify, because I think I did it in the episode too, that I know why movies do this. I understand that we want to be absolutely sure that you're going to be rooting for Owen Wilson and Adam Sandler and Jason Bateman, even though you're rooting for them anyway because they're on the poster of the movie you paid money to see. Just to be absolutely clear that there's no gray area whatsoever, we're going to have Bradley Cooper cheat on Rachel McAdams in front of Owen Wilson in a church if we can get it. I get why you're doing it. I just think that it's unnecessary and there are probably other ways.
Well, beyond. That's what's fun about this. I mean, yeah, that's the tacit agreement here is that we know that the movie has to do, or is choosing this particular outlet because it's the easiest, it's the path
we're just
of least
saying,
resistance.
Like, try harder,
but,
maybe.
Yeah. But also, like, yeah, once that shows up in several movies, you can start to point out a pattern and be like, this is not how it would ever go in real yeah. life. And that's right. what's fun. One of my favorites is the way that people lie in movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you have to lie to somebody, the audience has to know that the person is lying, so you have to telegraph to the dumbest person in the audience that this is a lie, which means that the person who's being lied to and believes the lie then has to be dumber than the dumbest person in the right. audience. So it's such a telegraph. It's a, like, the way that somebody will lie in a movie. Like, ask me what I did last night, Dan.
Soren, it's me, Dan, from work. What did you do last night?
Oh, let's see. I was at the dog park. I got a dog, and then I went to the dog park.
I buy it.
Yeah, it sounds genuine.
That sounds fun. You know what?
And then that's the end.
Dog.
You should bring your dog to meet my dog, and that's how movies happen.
Yeah. And that lie, yeah, that lie is so clumsy and awful. And every single time, the other person's like, "Sure, okay." Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Now, me as a smart person, I know you actually got a cat. Right?
Well, now I know where this movie goes because you show up to the dog park the next day with your son dressed as a dog.
Right.
And you are Mrs. Doubtfire
or
now.
It's me. I go and run. I'm like, I don't know where he is. And I run off to get him. And then I come back as a dog. And then as the dog, I go, I don't know where he is. And then I just keep going back and forth. So you never know that we're the same.
Yeah, I hate when movies are like that.
Off that trope, though, you know, I think it's also really funny when, like, somebody's very obviously lying and then the person goes, hey, are you telling me you got a dog?
Like, they give us that pause to make the audience be like, oh, no, they're going to catch him, and it's only the first 10 minutes of the movie. Oh, good.
Okay. They paid attention to the wrong thing.
I have a conversational one that I'm so tired of. When a person comes in and they're like, there's something I have to tell you, and they're like going to profess their love, and then the person says something that ruins their announcement, and they're like, but sorry, what were you going to say?
Yeah.
It's like, that wouldn't never fucking happen, you guys.
I make sure if anytime someone in real life comes up to me and says, hey, I have to tell you something, if I'm not in love with them, I say, yeah, you can real quick. But isn't it great? I just wanted to say, isn't it great how we could just be friends forever and like there's no tension? Go on and say what you're going to say. Just because I need to preempt it. I don't want it to be awkward for anyone.
Yeah, you do that.
That lie thing.
Caused a lot of problems.
I think Arrival was one of the only times that I saw someone do the right thing with a lie. It's mm-hmm. where Forrest Whitaker came up to Amy Adams and asked her some kind of question. And she was like, oh, we said this. In Greek, it means XYZ. And that's why we have to do this. She did some kind of like language thing or math thing at him. And he was like, all right, I'll tell the generals. And he left. And Jeremy Renner was like, that was cool. She goes, yeah, it's not true. I just lied to that man. And then they just continue.
Yeah.
Hey,
it's way
and
easier.
Like, yeah, good. That's fine. Yeah, I am the audience. I'm caught up now.
That's how smart people are. I do think a lot of it comes down to Like, I tend to like movies when the characters are smarter than they would realistically be, rather than dumber. A lot of my problems with movies could be solved by just being like, just pretend the characters are as smart as you, writer,
yeah,
and go from there, as opposed to like, and then they like look the other way while they do.
Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah. That we ever have to buy into that suspension of disbelief that the other character, that sometimes you usually see something that we're supposed to like, right, that they're just so egregiously dumb.
Yeah. One of the most eye-opening and refreshing moments in the last like 10 years of television writing was the episode of Breaking Bad where Skyler walks up to Walter in very early in the show and says, "You're a drug dealer," because she's operating at the height of her intelligence. And we didn't have to have three seasons of her being like, "Why do you smell like meth?" And he's like, "Oh, this kid at the park just threw some at me." He's like, "All right.
A kid was throwing stuff. Right. Oh, no.
I better go check that out."
Wait a second. You went to the park without me?
It's just nice that we didn't have three seasons where Walter had to clumsily lie and Skyler had to be an idiot who believed him for no reason. And then no other TV shows do that.
You have an upcoming episode of OPCD that's about relationships that only happen in movies and never anywhere else.
Yeah, and that's another thing similar to the tropes where I know why writers do it. The big ones that stick out to me are Zach Morris and Screech Powers, Ferris Bueller and Cameron, last name, and Bradley Cooper and Ed Helms in The Hangover, where it's cool guy and insane, socially deficient dork.
Right.
And like, Zach is a Native American track, football, basketball, wrestling star, lead in the school play, actual rock star.
Did you say he was Native American?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I don't think the show did for a couple of years, but
oh, wow.
Just threw it in there towards the end. Gets like close to almost a perfect score on his SATs and is wildly popular and beloved by everyone. And Screech is like a weird, creepy perv dude who makes robots, and they're best friends. Screech is the best man at his wedding. And I don't come from a world where like every set of friends are identical or anything like that, but those two are not friends. And Ferris and Cameron are not friends.
Yeah, I mean, look at even the behind-the-scenes stuff. What do you know about Saved by the Bell? As soon as everybody got off camera, Dustin Diamond was a dude who hung out by himself, and everyone else kind of kicked it.
Right.
Because, like, yeah, in the real world, these two people, if they were friends early on in life, like in first grade, before you even understand social rankings and things like that, the complexity of it, within 2 years, those two people drift apart, no matter what.
And it's not purely a coolness or popularity thing. It's what are those characters talk about? What do they have in common? Like when Ferris and Cameron aren't at a museum or baseball game or parade, what do they fucking talk about? Ferris is the guy who the whole school loves when he misses a day of school. Cameron missed that same day and no one gave a shit about anything. Yeah. No one's painting Save Cameron on a water tower or asking where he is. Ferris is the guy who's like, life moves pretty fast. You need to smell the roses. And Cameron is like, I'm clinically depressed. I don't think life moves fast. It feels cripplingly slow all the time. I hate my father.
Yeah.
They're also all really mean to each other. Yeah. Like, that's like not a friendship. It's just cruel.
Could you imagine those two sitting in Ferris's room just like on a Friday night listening to Tone Loc, whatever's out at the time, and Cameron trying to open up to Ferris about his dad being abusive?
Yeah.
And the way that Cameron would respond to that in like the least helpful way of like,
"Hey, you gotta slow down or life passes you by." Yeah. That doesn't apply to that situation, Ferris. Jesus Christ.
I'm so bummed. My parents got my sister a car and all I got was this computer, and poor Cameron just like fighting back tears.
My mom's dead.
Keep plastic wrap on all the furniture. I'm not allowed to sit on anything. I hate my father so much. Right. I get bullied by my best friend.
One's really straight edge, color within the lines, and the other is like the most morally relativistic greaseball, like Zach Morris, Bradley Cooper.
Yeah. It works in buddy cop movies because at least they're thrown together.
Right.
But as soon as they make them like actual, that they chose to be friends on their own accord, it's like, no.
Right. And The Hangover, too, it gets overlooked a lot because Galifianakis is the odd man in that one. And he's supposed to be. There's a plot reason.
They throw him in.
He's related to someone who's going to get married. So he's like sort of relevant for those reasons. And that's why he's on this trip and everyone doesn't like it. But Stu and Phil, the Ed Helms and Bradley Cooper characters, they're the ones who are supposed to think, oh, great, if Zach Galifianakis is here, he might ruin our fun bro trip. But, like, those two have nothing in common.
Right.
Bradley Cooper is total bro, douche kind of guy, and Ed Helms is neurotic, uptight, not fun. What were you gonna do in Vegas? Right. What was this trip supposed to be if Zach Galifianakis didn't get there? And I get the reason that movies do this is to, in any given situation, you want to see a variety, a diversity of reactions. So you want cool guy, you want uptight guy who has his reactions, and you want Zach Galifianakis' wild card reactions.
Yeah, but also just archetypes that rub up against each other.
Like yeah.
And when they're in a perilous situation, what happens then? That's more fun to watch, obviously. But
yeah, but unrealistic. Like I agree, I wouldn't want to watch a Hangover movie where it was three Bradley Cooper types
right.
going to Vegas.
That's exactly who goes to Vegas. Yeah, right. Exactly. I always like to think about the characters going to see a movie together. Like, what movie would they go to see? And, like, what would their reaction to that movie? Like, dumb people, especially. I think this holds true for, like, groups of friends where there's, like, one dumb person to say the dumb guy jokes. Like, Joey and Friends, Andy and Parks and Rec, Kramer kind of in Seinfeld.
Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. What movie can the friends go see with Joey where he's gonna be into it.
What's going on.
Right. He'll just be like, why wasn't there a sex scene? Or like, if you like take him to see 12 Years a Slave, he's gonna be like, ah, oh, that sex scene was pretty hot, or like something like that. Like, there's nothing that they could possibly have in common or like want right. to talk about after.
We watched Joey Tribbiani learn who Joseph Stalin was on the course of this right. show. What did they talk about at dinner?
Right.
Well, what, right. Like, he and Chandler lived together.
And
what
are,
did
like,
they do?
Best friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not only along with they're mean to each other, they also like infuriate each other.
Right.
Like, I never spend time with people who infuriate me all the time. I would be like, we're done. I don't want to be mad all the time.
They spend all their time bickering and then not laughing at each other's jokes.
Yeah.
Like, when they say really fucking funny stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like anyone outside of this immediate friend group, if Chandler was like, yeah, I found a roommate, it's going to be Joey. Joey, that dumb actor you're always complaining about? He's like always bringing women around. He's just like that disrespectful oaf. You're always getting on each other's nerves. Yeah, but I mean, like, could you imagine the kind of shenanigans we'd get into? How that would be entertaining in retrospect, perhaps, or to, yeah. I don't know, an all-seeing audience.
Yeah, I think I might have mentioned this before, but this is an actual thing in biblical historians, like, actually look at the difference between narrative logic and actual logic. And
I thought we were going with Jesus and Judas was the original cool guy and nerd guy.
Yeah, dude, nobody would hang out with Judas. Come on, that guy was such a joke. No, but like, they'll look at stories and see if they make a certain kind of sense, they were probably added after the fact. Whereas if they don't make any sense, essentially, then they were probably actually historically accurate. Mm-hmm. Mary and Joseph going back to Bethlehem because there was a Roman census to count everybody in their like city of origin makes sense in the story. You're like, yeah, sure, okay, so that's why they're going there, and you just move forward. But in reality, like, there's no way that anyone would go back to their city of origin, first of all, like, three generations ago. Like, that would be like asking me to go to Ireland now to go back and be counted, and then Rome didn't have the ability or like the need. Why yeah. would they even want that? That's an example of one where, like, there's no way that actually happened.
Right. If someone got word to me and they were like, hey, I'm from Rome, you need to get back to Bethlehem and be counted there. I'd be like, what are you reading from? Just write down Bethlehem for me. Just like, right. like just go back to Rome and just say that you counted me.
Yeah.
You seem like you're good at communicating. I live here now, so I can.
Obviously, what are they doing with that information? Like, how is right. that useful to anyone? To, like, send everyone back home to where they were from? Like, we forgot to do this 4 years ago or right. 10 years ago. We'd really like to just... We want to catch up.
Yeah. Right. So. The reason that they did it was because they needed Jesus to be from the same town as David, I think, because of certain prophecies and the Jewish faith and like where the Messiah was supposed to be from. So they just like made that happen. And probably there were like five different versions of that story, and that one just made the most sense in a narrative mm-hmm. structure. And so that's the one that lasted. Support for today's show comes from Squarespace. You guys, market research shows that listeners to the Crack Podcast are some of the most creative and intelligent people on the internet. It also tells us you're the most attractive people. So I know you've all got amazing ideas and beautiful art that you want to showcase on the internet.
Well, whatever your next big idea might be, you can count on Squarespace to help you create an eye-seducing online platform that brings it to life. Squarespace's beautifully designed templates and customizable features give you everything you need to look like an expert right from the start. And if you ever have a problem, it doesn't matter how technical or stupid sounding, Squarespace's award-winning 24/7 customer support will help you out. Think of them as your own personal IT department without any of the judgment of normal IT departments. So start your free trial at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACK to get 10% off your first purchase plus a free domain. Again, that's squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED for 10% off your first purchase and a free domain. Squarespace, make your next move, make your next website. The Crack Podcast is also sponsored today by Casper, the disembodied soul of a dead child who haunts mid-90s Christina Ricci. Yes, it is that, but also it is the obsessively engineered mattress sold online at a shockingly fair price. You're going to be so shocked, and I don't mean to overpromise here, but you're going to be so shocked that it will cause you to completely recalibrate your concept of reality and what's possible in the universe. And the reason it's so shocking that it's such a good price is it's made with supportive memory foam, which creates an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink, just the right bounce. And the best part is you can try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund everything, even the shipping, which is free, by the way, in the US and Canada. Yes, they ship a frickin' mattress and pick it up for free. And they'll give you $50 towards any mattress purchase if you just visit casper.com/cracked and use offer code cracked at checkout. So once again, that's casper.com/cracked and use cracked at checkout for $50 off any mattress. Terms and conditions apply, as they often do. Thanks, Casper, and thank you.
Hey, Jack, did you want to talk about Die Hard 2?
Yeah, there's a certain type of character that kind of drives me crazy. I did a recent episode of the Spit Take where we called them movie straw men, where it's just they're characters that sort of argue for whatever will block the protagonist, even though like there's no rational reason for it. For instance, in Die Hard 2, there is an airport cop, the airport chief of police at the airport that's clearly being taken over by terrorists. And, you know, John McClane is like shooting the terrorists. And this airport cop is like, get out of my airport, hotshot. You think you're some big deal because you stopped terrorists last year? Well, I'll tell you what, just because you shot two terrorists this time doesn't mean they were terrorists, and like just doesn't make any sense and is just immediately antagonistic.
If you inform me of one more terrorist in my airport, I'm going to throw you out of the airport.
Right, exactly. Oh. And I think the patron saint of this is the mayor in Jaws, who is like, yeah, we've got to keep the beaches open. It's so important to me that we keep the beaches open. He like stakes his whole reputation, the reputation of his city, on like the idea that the beaches will be open on July 4th, even though like there are people being eaten out in the ocean, and like it just doesn't really make any sense whatsoever. And also the fact that the stakes would be that high because there are other beaches. Amity is not the only beach in the world, no. I'm pretty sure. So like people could just go swimming somewhere else. Right. He should have just immediately counted his losses and been like, well, I guess no one's fucking coming here on the 4th of July. Because
or just realize like, well, shouldn't have campaigned as the always keep beaches open.
Right.
Really should have rethought that.
Big yeah. Beach really is going to be mad at him.
So important to him. Yeah, and then the EPA guy in Ghostbusters is pretty pretty fired up just immediately. And
already has an axe to grind as soon as he gets there. Yeah.
Yeah, just immediately. Doesn't believe that these people are Ghostbusters, even though everyone's like literally seen them bust ghosts. And he's like, yeah, you and your like, whatever you're doing to cause hallucinations in us, or like it's a light show with some gases that made us hallucinate stuff. It's like, that's never been a thing. Like that's not a rational explanation for anything ever.
That seems to happen always in a movie where there's some sort of bank heist or a hostage situation and the SWAT team gets there. Because the SWAT team leader is always a dude who's just like, let me throw my men into gunfire. And like, no, you don't understand. This is what they've got in there. Shut up. I'm going to send my men in there to die.
Yeah.
Then we'll know what we're dealing with.
We are the FBI. And that means that we're sending people in.
The EPA guy is really egregious. I love his first scene with Venkman where he's like, hello, Mr. Venkman. Oh, Dr. Venkman. Doctor, what are you exactly a doctor of? And he mentions two PhDs that he has. And they're not like, I have a PhD, a pretty huge dick. It's like an actual like thing that he got. Like, there are two things that he went to school for a very long time to get. And the guy's just like, uh-huh. Well, I'm with the EPA, and you're going to shut this thing down.
Yeah, he's immediately a dick. And it's funny because like the guy that he brings with him, the blue-collar worker who's designed to shut the machine down, is on their side the whole time. He's the only rational person there who's like, oh, these guys sound like they know what they're talking about. I've seen the news in the last 3 days. They've got some ghosts.
The cop is, too. He brings, like, the hard hat guy from the electric company, I guess, and a cop. And he's like, electric company guy, shut that down. I don't know. I've never seen this before. And then he tells the cop, if Dr. Venkman moves again, you can shoot him.
Yeah.
And the cop goes, you just do your job, and I'll do mine. That's not how. Yeah.
They're so aggressive to the point where they're like overstepping all bounds of anything. Yeah. Just being like, you shoot him. I don't like what he's saying.
Yeah, the EPA has martial law in this world. Yeah, and I guess in Ghostbusters, I can kind of buy it because there are huge assholes in the real world who like don't have a great grasp on reality. But then in Ghostbusters 2, the almost more famous movie.
Oh, the mayor.
The mayor, what?
In Ghostbusters 2 is like that. The mayor in Ghostbusters 2.
Everybody is like that. At the beginning of Ghostbusters 2, the entire world besides the Ghostbusters has just decided that it was all like a hoax for some reason.
Yeah.
And the Ghostbusters who saved all of New York City from Ghost 9/11 are working children's birthday parties. And, like, the kids are like, fuck you, loser.
Yeah. I mean, we wish you were He-Man, but we're not. We're
real
Ghostbusters.
Right.
So the whole world becomes these straw.
Yeah, exactly. They all caught the bullshit argument from the EPA guy. Sully saved a plane full of people in New York City, and we still worship him as a hero. Like, if he showed up at a kid's birthday party, they'd be like, holy fuck, it's Sully! Like, the parents would at least be, like, amazed. Yeah. But, like, the Ghostbusters show up, and they're like, get in the back.
Yeah.
Like, can you do balloon animals?
Right.
No,
what
we
else
saved
happening?
Your life!
Like, what else is happening in the world of Ghostbusters where the city has been in jeopardy so many times between these two movies that these guys are completely forgotten by society?
Right.
Like, there must be some insane things happening there.
Pink slime. Maybe that's what it is.
The Die Hard one also, I could almost understand the airport cop if he wasn't aware of Die Hard 1. But it's made known that it's like, yeah, I saw what you did last year because everyone did, but I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
The line that he says that always gets me is like, I don't know how they do things in L.A. And he says it in like L.A. is some podunk fucking nowhere town.
Right, right. But here, I'm an airport cop. Yeah, and if anything, I think the cop should at least hold John McClane for questioning because he's shooting people on the one-year anniversary of the last time he shot a bunch of terrorists. So the logical thing would actually be that he's just, like, having PTSD or something because, like, there's no way that there's another terrorist attack going on, or at least it's extremely unlikely. But instead, he's like, get this guy out of my office. He just shot two people in my airport.
Send him home.
On Christmas, yeah. All right. I have the mirror over the sink. Closing, revealing scary thing behind you is still something that, I mean, we've been pointing that out as a trope that needs to die for about 10 years, and it's still like a thing that they put in the trailers. And Soren, speaking of the bathroom, you have a thing that people do in their bathroom sinks that drives you crazy.
This has been a gripe of mine for a long time. Please stop peeing your sinks, everyone. No.
You're mad that movies, no one is ever peeing in sinks. That's where pee goes. And you're like, why are they doing it in the sacred toilet?
When it's four steps closer. No, my gripe, and it's a gripe that I've had for a long time, is the way that people brush their teeth in movies. Now,
we're going to let Brett come in on this one.
Carmen, you're fresh to this idea. So, so let me hear from your perspective. After you've decided you push the brush around in your mouth enough and you're done, what are the next steps of toothbrushing for you?
You brush it and then you spit.
And then what?
You wash off
The toothbrush.
The toothbrush, and then you put it back in your mouth and you do it again.
Okay. And then,
when you're done, you just wash it off.
I was not expecting that dark horse. But and then once, like, when you're, let's say after the second brushing.
Okay.
You spit again, you wash off the toothbrush,
and then
you do spit out, so you like rinse your mouth out with some water? Do you do any of that?
Yeah.
Okay, that feels normal to me.
You almost didn't include it in your steps because it's so normal. Because you assumed that Soren knew that you washed your mouth out with water and spit out.
Yeah.
So in movies, every single movie I've ever seen in which somebody's brushing their teeth, first of all, there's no foam all over their mouth, which does not happen.
Right.
Second of all, that they can like be brushing and having a conversation with somebody and take the brush out every once in a while to talk to them is insane.
Yeah.
But then at the end, when they're done, what they do is they spit, put the toothbrush down and walk away, and that's it. There's still like four more steps there that right. They're not accounting for. They're leaving the toothbrush all sudsy and gross and just like putting it back down, and then they spit once, and then they're not going to rinse their mouth out with water. They're not going to have a drink of water after that. Like, it's insane. It's insane that you can get everything out.
Full of toothpaste.
Yeah.
And then I watched, and I can't concentrate on whatever happens in the rest of that scene because I just know what's sitting on the sink and what's in their mouth at that moment.
Yeah, they don't even run the water after they spit.
No, they just spit and put the toothbrush down. Like, I'm done with this.
That's also the grossest toothbrush. Brushing with gross.
All that calcified fluoride all over the base and the back of it, and the bristles are,
and the food is on the bristles because you didn't wash it off, so,
Like, every screenwriter will go to a hotel and they brush their teeth and see a little empty cup next to the bathroom sink, and they're like, what the fuck is that for?
Brett, is that Brett has a different beef with movie toothbrushing.
There's also a thing they do where they kind of just hold the brush perpendicular or parallel to the jawline, right? It's hard to describe, and they just kind of go in a little circular motion.
And their teeth are closed?
Their teeth are closed and their lips are open. They're not brushing their teeth.
Right.
It's just...
Yeah, it is rare. I think it's only in movies where, like, I've seen people in the middle of an argument that the toothbrush is all the way in the back at the molars.
Right.
And they have to pull it out to talk every once in a while. But you're right. In general, the way that you would see an old movie, an old show for schools where, like, there's a fake set of teeth and somebody's brushing it.
Right.
Like, that's how people brush their teeth in movies.
Yeah.
It's like these small little circles and you only cover the first four teeth. And then after that, fuck the molars. Who cares?
I didn't know how to brush my teeth for the longest time. There's one thing that's not really a movie trope, but it happens in movies and there's really no other opportunity to take it. So I'm going to take my time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Say it now. When you're watching someone eating with a fork in a movie, sometimes there's that little bit of Foley where they put the fork in their mouth and there's a clinking sound as they put the food in their mouth, which drives me crazy because that means the person is like tapping the fork to their teeth. Who does that?
Terrible.
I mean, I'm someone who has, like, if I see forks or silverware rubbing up against each other, my bones crawl. Mm. And same thing with my teeth. Mm. But nobody does that. Nobody clinks the fork or knife to their teeth.
The sound is wrong, too. It's like it's them clinking it on fillings. Like, that's metal on metal that you're hearing.
And if you did that, you would have that. Like, anybody who bites their fork ever is usually like...
Just listen for it. It's very subtle, and it doesn't happen all the time, but it happens a lot. Yeah.
They do it always.
I've been thinking about it for a while, actually. I just didn't know, like, what to do with this information. But it's not just the sound, but a lot of times people eating in movies very aggressively, like, bite at their fork, like they have their food, and then they make a whole action out of like lunging and biting and getting that metal on metal sound in a way that, like, I'm so cautious and normal when I eat. I'm always looking at the food and making sure it's going where it's supposed to go. And there are people who, like, will say something and then punctuate it without
and bite at their fork like the fork itself will disintegrate in their mouth.
Right. Yeah. That's how my son tried to eat the first time. Like, we used a spoon. He was like, just like held on to the spoon, but it wasn't metal. So
I wonder because we generally understand why tropes in movies happen. We're just sick of them. I wonder what early movies found was the reason to not have people wash their mouth out after they brush their teeth. If they're worried that that's too much business, then why wouldn't you just cut away? Just like, elide time by cutting to later, now he's in bed, and we can assume he did the normal toothpaste things. Like,
I don't know. That in movies, the actors are doing, or even in the first few that this happened in, the actors are doing all the motions. But when you get to editing, and you're like, what's all this business? You just cut all that shit out. because a lot of times what happens is you see them brush, you see them do the spit, and then there's a change because they're walking away from the sink. Mm-hmm. So, like, you cut to another angle. And probably what happened is they were still doing all of the business, and then either the director on the day was like, it's too much, you can't talk while you're doing that. Or just in editing, they were like, well, we can just cut immediately to this.
Yeah, and I'm sure after they saw it get cut once, they were just like, all right, well,
we can get away with
this. And also, I don't know that if you told me to pantomime, like, brushing my teeth right now, if I would think to include the washing my mouth out.
True.
Because
I forgot to mention
I'm a fool.
It's so important. I would even say that there's another step that's missing, which is after you rinse the brush off, then the brush has got a lot of, like, still wetness in the brush.
So you
suck the brush or you shake it out.
Yeah.
And then you spit again.
I'd shake out the brush.
I do
certainly.
The shake.
Yeah.
Suck it. Gross, yeah. Man.
I also have an electric toothbrush, so my miming would be very different than Jack's miming. Should we all mind brushing our teeth for the podcast?
All right. Well, I'm glad you got that off your chest.
Yeah.
Soren's
yeah.
apparently been wanting to talk about this since before he worked for Cracked.
Yeah, and I'm not usually bothered by things like this, but that really will take me out of a movie. I just can't hang.
I think you've pitched that as like a soul After Hours episode. Like that was the only thing that needed to be discussed.
I wanted to do that. Yeah, I wanted just an After Hours episode that was just that, and then people in movies who are fiddling with their radio in the car, and I know an accident's about to happen.
Yeah.
You can't play with your radio in the car without getting into an accident.
I can't concentrate on movie scenes that are happening in cars because I'm positive that a car accident's going to happen. I'm like, why are you doing it in a car if they're not about to die of a car? Like, even if it's like Seinfeld, I'll be like, there's clearly an accident.
I still actually have like a visceral reaction if somebody's turned their head while they're driving and talking too long. I literally, like, during the film, I'll be like, turn.
Right. Yeah. have you ever done that? I'm trying to, because so many movies, even if there's not an accident, people will fully turn their head profile to talk to someone. And like, I was just driving down the Kern River with friends, and it's beautiful because it had just rained, so everything is lush and green, and also there's this babbling fucking river. And I'm just like, eyes on the road, because I don't want to crash. Like, I don't want to turn and look too long at the beautiful scenery because I don't want to die.
Well, and that's not even how conversations work. You don't have to be looking at someone for them to hear you.
Yeah.
So, like, or for you to hear them. So, when you have a conversation in the car, both of you are just staring straight ahead out the windshield. That's how it works.
I actively avoid eye contact during conversations. Like, what are people talking about? Speaking of fiddling with the radio, heavy metal music fans are really stupid in movies, huh?
Yeah.
Go through
the list of all of them. Yeah. There's so many.
Wayne and Garth, Bill and Ted, Spinal Tap, Mark Wahlberg and Rockstar, Airheads, Otto and the Simpsons. That's all I have written down, but that's a lot of iconic ones that it's like it just got imprinted in like 1988 or something when like metal was first a thing and it was like a thing teenagers were into. And ever since then, we've just gone with that.
I should paint a picture for the audience here. Right before Jack brought this up, he took off his sweater and revealed a Guns N' Roses t-shirt underneath.
Yeah, bro.
A well-worn Guns N' Roses t-shirt.
This is from the 88 tour, man.
I was there.
I think the dumb metalheads is a good counter to sophisticated murderers who listen to classical music.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this guy's a murderer. How do we give him some kind of edge? Put orchestral music in his earphones. Ooh, depth.
Right.
He's sophisticated.
So smart. Now have him solve a Rubik's Cube, and he's the smartest person.
That is weird. Yeah, it's music that's associated with the dumbest of the dumb. That if you like this movie, I'm in this movie. If you like this music, you are an automatic idiot.
Yeah.
Or have to talk like one, at least. You have to be like, whoa.
None of them are smart. I mean, even our protagonists aren't smart. Bill and Ted are not smart.
No.
I mean, have people ever, like, spoken, like, especially the heavy metal crowd, like, have they been like, excuse me.
excuse me, sir.
I'm completely misrepresented in films.
Well, it's either they're kind of idiots or they're weirdos in Green Room, I guess, is a weird example because it's about like a weird Nazi compound. But David Fincher movies, I feel like you will see like these weird sort of underground clubs that only exist to like have creepy shit happen there, like to have like weird violent sex things happen. Yeah, and like the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I feel like there's like a lot of metal being scary, creepy stuff.
Yeah, a lot of those. Metal is definitely associated with a lot of weird sex things, and there's no room for someone with some shades of gray where it's like, oh, this is our club where we get into hacking, piercing, fucking, and metal. And it's like, I like two of those. Do I have to do all of them? Okay. All right. I'll learn hacking.
Yeah. I guess The Big Short kind of contradicted this because they had Christian Bale's character listen to a lot of metal.
I was going to bring that up. That was the one refreshing counter to this, where he was like clearly a genius and also just like really liked his loud metal music.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm thinking about how that was worn off of me in culture, and I'm wondering if this is, if I'm right, or if this has all become ingrained in me. But when I look at Insane Clown Posse, if I know somebody's a fan of the Insane Clown Posse, I'm like, that person's dumb.
I think it's,
but I don't know. Maybe they're not.
No, I mean, Nathan Raven's really, I mean, because he covered them, but he's one of my favorite writers, and he is real into the Insane Clown Posse.
I wonder if that's how everybody felt about glam bands at the time. And then people like Chuck Klosterman came along and wrote Fargo, Rock City, and really defended this as like as actual musical canon and a good part of the evolution of music history.
Well, it's all very like classist, I feel like, you know? I don't even know how to say that word. I'm so American.
Well, on the note of music, this is a music thing that I feel like, I don't know if this is accurate for, this doesn't ring true for me. With when women in movies get broken up with, they always eat a bunch of food and listen to very sad music. As far as I know, I don't listen to very sad music when I'm sad. I try everything in my power to cheer the fuck up.
And meanwhile, that's exactly what I did when I would get broken up with by someone in college.
It might be
like
a boy thing.
Not eat a bunch of ice cream, but I would just like, let me drive around and indulge this sadness for a while by putting on a CD that reminds me of her and like sad romantic music and just like be sad in a car for a while. Maybe I learned that from movies.
I think we learned that from movies.
There's something that feels good about it. Maybe it is a boy thing, and that's why our screenwriters who were boys wrote that in and just assumed women did the same thing. But it's cathartic. I can think of like ending a relationship in high school and then cathartically putting on music that was even sadder to like really wallow in it.
Yeah. Right.
But like now as an adult, I guess, or in your adult dating life, did you find yourself, you said in high school definitely, but like did you find yourself doing that? And like I had a trained moment where like I had gotten broken up with and I was like, should I be doing this? Do I need to go through this process?
I definitely don't do it now, and it's breakups is another Hollywood trope that they get completely wrong and they do over and over again. I feel like I get very adult about breakups now in a way that like movies, this is an actual conversation in real life that I had where a relationship ended and someone was like, oh, you need to just get out there. And I was like, I don't think I do. I think movies invented that. I think that's the thing that like makes movies plots go forward is like, oh, Ross and Rachel broke up. Let's weave into the DNA that men are supposed to go and date other people because that will be more narratively fulfilling and exciting than Ross sits around taking stock of this relationship and like diagnosing why it ended, which is what I do as a human being. That full run-on sentence is probably exactly what I said to someone who was like, you need to just get out there, bro. And I was like, I've been thinking about that, and I have an essay for you.
And also, I feel like the people who give the advice, you need to get out there, bro, are just giving that advice because they saw it in movies.
Yeah.
Like, because it doesn't benefit them at all.
Also, the best friend especially with a woman, if she's been broken up with, always comes over with wine. Like, it literally is like
I'm
a run-over moment. Like,
chocolate and wine.
Like, just for you. They're just like, okay, like, I am here to talk. Like, what if like, I'm so sorry. I actually have to do surgery, but I'll be there later. I don't know.
Cancel my surgeries. My friend got broken up with.
Right. Or just like, I mean, I'm glad you showed up with wine and everything, but I'm really depressed. I don't think a depressant is what I need right now.
Also, some people just want to be alone, like, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Or like, but like the friend who's like eagerly, like literally pulling people out of bed. Like if I was really sad and my friend physically pulled me out of bed, I'd be like, stop it.
Yeah.
Right.
Because you're not being a good friend right now.
Assaulting me.
All of my friends have been deeply respectful if I'm like, oh, I got broken up with. Oh, we should go out tonight. I wouldn't be fun tonight. I understand that.
Yeah.
Come on, I'm making you. You are coming out. Speaking of showing up with food, groceries are always carried in bags where they're poking out of
just
the top
baguette.
Of the
bags. Yeah, the baguette and some celery or carrot stalks or whatever the fuck is happening at the top there
with
its greenery.
Some food poking out of the top.
That is
of
weird. Yeah, they stuff their bags so full and they're going home with a baguette.
Right.
Who's going home with a baguette every week? And also, I would like to eat at their place.
Yeah, baguettes are fucking great. The fact that you can't use name brands, I feel like fucks with me in certain ways. Like, it used to fuck with me with smoking because people would be like, give me a pack of smokes at the store. Or, like, with beer, I'd like a beer, one beer, please. And they would just, like, slide them a beer. But now the main way it fucks with me is search engines.
That's anytime such a great have to analogy.
Use search engines, they fucking, like, use internet search. Wikipedia or like some shit, and it's just like a box.
It's that, their
like,
phone operating systems too.
Right.
Phone operating systems are so silly in movies and shows.
Yeah.
It always took me out of it with video games growing up because you couldn't say name brand video games. And I don't envy them because how do you make up the name of a video game convincingly? No one was good at it. It was almost always like, what are you doing? Oh, I'm really into Death Volley Kill Split or whatever. Right. Something that was like, like, how can you communicate to the audience that this is a violent game? As quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And I'm just, as a kid, just like, just say fucking Mortal Kombat. What are you doing? Like, just do it.
Just to say Mortal Kombat, do you need the rights to Mortal Kombat? You do?
Brett nodded. I don't know if you do. I mean, I'm just going based on the fact that movies always say I'm playing Death Exploder instead of Mortal Kombat.
But like,
I wonder if that's just because there's this part in the Spike Lee movie Clockers that I like more than 99% of the world, but I don't like it more than 99% of the world. Like, it's my favorite thing in the world. I like it more than most people. but he, like, makes up this fake game where, like, kids ride around on their bike and, like, shoot people, and it's, like, to prove a point about, like, violence and video games and stuff. I feel like that's kind of what they're doing, where they're, like, Death Exploder 1, because, like, Mortal Kombat would be, like, too below the radar.
I think it is illegal. I think that it's, I mean, we've done Star Wars parody stuff, and we're not allowed to say X-Wing in it and stuff like that.
We're not allowed to say droid.
Yeah.
But I also...
Oh, shit.
There's... I think we're overlooking...
Are we going to have to bleep both of those?
Oh, we took care of it.
I do think we're overlooking what a rite of passage it is for writers, which is something that didn't occur to me until 2 weeks ago. I was at a friend's birthday, and Caldwell is an animator. Friend Caldwell Tanner, he's a great guy. Talking to other animators, and he was like, guys, I got to name my first soda. And that was, like, a thing that all the other animators nodded at, like, and they all had their first sodas that they named. He just came up with the name. The name of his soda brand was Splish. And everyone was like, yeah, that's funny, and it sounds like a soda thing that would exist. That's a good, like, that's some kind of rite of passage or, like, a bucket list for writers. Like, I named a town, I named a soda, I named a video game.
Yeah.
Maybe just people having fun.
I think I can
maybe that's all movies are.
No. It's not fun. It's gotta be serious. I can, like, even picture Splish's label. Well, like, done, Splish. Tanner.
Looks a little like Squirt.
Yeah. And you can think about Simpsons writers sitting around trying a bunch of things and then be like, no, Duff. Duff is the name that makes sense for the beer in this town. It's Duff Beer and Duff Man.
No, I think you're right. It's like naming a character. There's, like, a real indulgence in it that you can tell that writers enjoy. That they can name the last name of the kid in The Sixth Sense Seer.
Yeah.
Like, as Seer. Like, it makes perfect sense that when you have a product in a show, you can be like, all right, well, how do I make this fucking product a metaphor for everything?
Right.
And then that's where they really get to indulge in their silliness.
You still haven't gotten back to me on the first draft of my novel starring John Everyman.
I'm just compiling my notes.
I've noticed that if someone tells the protagonist, don't trust anyone, usually that means they will double cross them later and say, I told you not to trust anyone.
Oh,
I feel like that's
happened
in 90 movies.
And it's, like, so smarmy. I told you not to trust anyone.
Yeah, Littlefinger said that to Ned Stark with a knife to his throat. I did warn you never to trust me. I'm like, yeah, you did. You're right.
Is that satisfying for you?
I notice that karaoke, I feel like, is the, like, I don't know why everybody, whenever they do karaoke, has, like, this moment of, like, them having a catharsis on stage. For example, Gilmore Girls, she she tells the guy that she likes,
Luke,
that she'll love him forever, singing, I Will Always Love You. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I see that so much in films and movies and TV, that a character does karaoke to, like, communicate and, like, have this catharsis, but it's like, I have never had... I enjoy karaoke, but I've never catharsis.
Right. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is watching Zooey Deschanel sing, and they lock eyes, and he decides that they're in love. Every time I've sung karaoke, I don't want to look at anybody. Right. I don't want anyone to see me, because then what if they know that it's me doing karaoke?
You are more in your head doing karaoke than the first time you have sex with a new person.
Yeah.
Like, you are not in any capacity to be, like, oh, and now I'm having a moment with you. Like, I'm sharing something special. No, I've got to focus on these fucking words and getting the tune right, because if I don't, I'm going to be embarrassed
just
myself.
Just like sex.
I know the words. I'm glad the words are there as a crush that I'd be like, I got to focus. I have this task. So you guys could just, like, ignore me. Right. I'm not going to connect with any of you.
Because you also always forget, like, you're up there, the music is playing, you're like, shit, what was the words? And so you're, like, reading the words, and then I would never have time to, like, look over and be like, hey.
Right.
And then keep singing.
This is for you. I'm telling you with my eyes.
This next part of Bust a Move is about the two of us.
Right. I was just going to say, yeah, Dan's performance of Bust a Move at the Christmas party was clearly very meaningful for him and someone else. Yeah, it is always a very meaningful thing. If you walk into a room and start talking before receiving confirmation that the other person that you think you're talking to is in the room, they're either dead, missing, or being held at gunpoint by a bad guy.
Yeah.
Like, if you kind of jump the gun on that, there's something going on.
Well, yeah. Anytime that you see someone walking in their own front door and shouting to someone else, there's no reason
Honey?
For that other
Honey?
Than yeah. to set yeah. that up. Because otherwise you just get right into the scene of them talking. You just get in the house.
This is full circle to the first trope about men walking in on their wives cheating, because it's my favorite example that I didn't cover at the beginning of this episode, which is Colin Firth walks into his home and sees his brother there, and they're talking about how they should go to their mom's birthday or something. And then you just hear Colin Firth's wife yell, "Get back here, big boy. I want you at least twice more before your brother, my husband, gets home." It's like, definitely shout about cheating in your own home.
Yeah. Honey, are you coming back? Like that, just like somebody in another room saying that. Well, the person that you're talking to is clearly disheveled and something has gone on with them. Right. Yeah.
Also, the amount of time they're gone is not long enough to be are you coming back?
God, you're so needy.
Yeah, that they've been fuck catatonic in the other room and can't get up to, like, unsure about what's going on. Like, they're just sitting up, like, laying out on the bed convulsing.
Yeah. Why aren't you fucking me again? I hate my husband. He's your brother. Did someone open the door, by the way?
This is a nice segue for another one that I want to talk about, because it's sex-related, and it's a little dark, and I don't want to end on it
for that reason. Well, we're not ending.
Good. Then I can slide it in here. This is...
slide it in here.
No, you're not going to want to say that when you hear what I'm about to say. In movies, when a woman is... there's an attempted rape, and a man saves her, there's like a weird, agreed-upon sexual palate cleanse where then she wants to have sex with the guy who saved her. Like, that's such a... Or kiss him, or, like, do something romantic with the guy who just saved her from almost being raped. And that's the last thing I think anybody would want to do after they were almost raped, is think about sexuality in any capacity.
Right.
But immediately, that's either where she falls in love, or she decides that this is somebody she wants to do.
It's like movie sex algebra.
Yeah. True Detective Season 2 did it with Rachel McAdams almost getting raped at this party, and Colin Farrell saves her, and it's like some weird... idea that the writers had, that it was like, well, clearly she's got sex on her mind because sex almost happened, but she couldn't do it before. Now there's a good guy. He saved her, so
now she can
still get
it.
That sex out of the way that we all knew was coming. And it was like, no. Rape is a very traumatic thing that's not like, you want to step away from the whole world of sex for a little while. It's not like... Let's take care of this with a good guy.
Lord of the Rings is another... I mean, not Lord of the Rings.
Game of Thrones
is another one. I'm thinking of, like, where Sam and his wildling girlfriend, that she almost gets raped and then she has sex with Sam because he saved her. And, like, it's so clearly not for the person in the movie. It's just a palate cleanse for the audience of, like, that's bad sex. That's good sex. Okay, I know now. I got it.
And we can still like sex.
Yeah.
On a similar note, I think I've mentioned this before, is like when in movies guys will just trick kiss girls.
Mm-hmm. Like, do like a cool kick flip with your skateboard and then kiss someone.
Right. Like, you know, they'll be like, come here, and then they'll like kiss them. Like in The Mummy, the original Mummy, not the new one. He like constantly kisses her. And it's a romantic one, but he'll
They steal
like,
kisses. They literally steal kisses.
Like, here, I'm gonna tell you a secret and then kiss them on the mouth.
Yeah, or he'll be like, he was like, hey, I gotta tell you something, and she's like, what, and then he pulls her in and he like kisses her, and then he's like, get me out of here, and I was like, you didn't even have to kiss, you just said get me out of here. It's a lot of kisses stolen in that movie.
Yeah,
quite a few movies where men will just take them from women, and most of the time, if it's early, like in the first act or the second act, she's not on board at all.
No.
Like, she's really pissed that he did that. And then we're like, it's fine. They'll fall in love eventually.
Yeah. Well, that's of the many plot holes in Inception, that's one that always sticks out to me, that Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Ellen Page are hanging out, and there's been no sexual tension with them or anyone in this movie, because Chris Nolan doesn't know how to write about sex.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, the bad dream police are onto them. Just Gordon Levin's like, quick, kiss me. And she does. And he's like, did that do anything? And he's like, nah, it was worth a shot. Which is like, clearly he wanted to steal that kiss from her. That doesn't pay off anywhere. Right. She's like, what the fuck are we doing? Just like, Joseph Gordon Levin's like, in the middle of this mission, I'm going to hook up with this college student. And then be like, nah, that was fun.
Or the distraction
kiss. Way to go.
The distraction kiss where they're like, quick, kiss me. And then, like, for some reason, that would make people definitely be like, oh, I can't see.
They're invisible.
When your lips touch, you become invisible to him.
Are those criminals? Oh, no, criminals can't kiss each other. They wouldn't kiss. They're doing crimes.
I would just like to see that at some point. It's usually in, like, alleys and stuff like that where two people kiss and then the police all run by. It's like, the police would run by just two people kissing and not be like, what are they doing out in public?
Speaking of movie kisses, I think that I've seen in movies more kisses happen where the woman starts out struggling against it, but then eventually relents, like eases into it, than I've seen just normal kisses happen. That's how common it is.
That's
like,
true.
Where like women are like, no, I don't want to be, but
oh,
now
what a persuasive
you kissed
tongue.
Me long enough that, I have now been convinced.
I like the
logic. Yeah, that's a bummer.
In Captain America Winter Soldier, where Scarlett Johansson is like, quick, Chris Evans, kiss me on this escalator because public displays of affection make people uncomfortable. If beautiful Chris Evans and beautiful Scarlett Johansson, that's the only thing I want to look at in the world. Like, yeah, that's who's supposed to kiss. Let's all cheer.
See, there's somebody for everybody. I've always said that. I'm so glad they found each other.
You're just like, oh, that's how beautiful people kiss. Yeah. Nice.
Chinese food. Always eaten out of Chinese food containers. Never on a plate. Never in a dish. That's just a rule.
Yeah. That is. It's always in a living room, so they clearly have their... Right. They have that shit available to them, but instead they're like, just eat out of the box. And we're going to share out of boxes, too.
Yeah.
That's very strange.
Yeah, and it's usually the sign of either you're working hard and late, or things aren't going real well for you.
Yeah. You're a real mess.
Yeah, yeah. Jesus, they're eating Chinese.
Has anyone, when they've ended a relationship, let their apartment go to shit? Because that's another, like, there's three-day-old Chinese food on the floor of someone who just broke up with their significant other. Is that?
Yes.
Oh, really?
There's a lot.
That happens a lot in movies. I didn't know if I was weird for, like... I give myself lots of tasks after a sad thing happens, and, like, cleaning my apartment is one of them that, like, well, this is normally where I think about the love that I have in my life, but I guess I'll just, like, deep clean my bathroom instead.
No, I get the messies.
Oh.
I get the messies.
That's such a charming way to refer to it, to what is, like,
sounds
an objectively
like
pretty
diarrhea,
awful
though.
Thing.
It won't catch on because it sounds too much like diarrhea.
I'm not going to come into work today. I got a case of the messies.
Yeah.
Another thing that happens in movies, people get broken up with and then diarrhea for like 3 days.
Just a classic.
It's all the Chinese food, man.
Man, you know who's you wouldn't want taking care of you in reality if movie...
I mean,
the craziest profession is orderlies.
Okay.
Male orderlies are generally really like male nurse type.
Oh,
like any
yeah.
profession that is wearing nurse scrubs.
I wanted to do a bit about it. I was really hoping you were going to leave it open ended and just, you know who you wouldn't want taking care of you from movies? And I could be like, Shark from Jaws. The monkey who is good at baseball, but we have no reason to think
any
he'd be good at taking care of me.
Any of the robots from iRobot.
Any of the robots from Short Circuit. Any of the people in Police Academy.
One of the old people from Battle is not included.
But yeah, Kill Bill, Sucker Punch, Happy Gilmore. Terminator 2, the guy who just like goes up and licks her face when she's like down and out. We don't trust men in scrubs, maybe? In
men
in scrubs?
My brother is an occupational therapist and is like the sweetest person on the planet. And everybody who works with also. It's like I'm not saying everyone in the world is perfect, but like this is specifically a profession that requires a lot of work and attracts a specific kind of like altruistic person. Because if you're an orderly, even like lowest level orderly in a hospital, you're cleaning shit. You're cleaning like actual shit off of people, and you're oftentimes dealing with people who are like very cantankerous and awful to you. The kind of person doesn't get into that business. I'm like, I'm really just here to lick faces when people are asleep.
They're right.
Like, no, I'm doing this because I'm answering a calling that I think is important to
do. It's just so inconceivable to an audience that you would give yourself to such an altruistic job and not try and, like, if you're a man, mm-hmm. that you wouldn't aim for doctor, that you would be like, I'm going to stay at orderly. And it's so thankless, and it doesn't pay great. And why anyone would want to stay in that job, then audience
What's
will not
this
believe.
Creep all about?
Right. Like a guy in Kill Bill where it's like, oh, yeah, I thought about being a doctor, but then I found out there's a lot more money if I charge people to fuck women in comas. It's just, and like so much less work for me. So that's just my job. Right. That's what I do.
I think it is like the film industry kind of shaming people, men who go into that type of a job, because it's like women's work. It's like nurses, you know? But like, even in Meet the Parents.
Yeah.
That was his job, and everybody. That was the butt of the joke.
That was a joke. Just like a male nurse. Ha! Yeah, right. People who do that for a living have an excess of empathy. Like, that's the one thing that, like, is required of them. Speaking of people in uniform, anybody who, like, works in a custodial capacity and is wearing headphones will be completely oblivious to the world around them. Like, you could.
They have the best noise-canceling headphones in the world. Did they even cut out vibrations and, like, particles of glass that fly past them?
Yeah. This transfers to the surgical assistant in Westworld. Someone's being violently murdered next to him, and he's, like, listening to his music and jamming out.
If you want janitors to be oblivious, our high school janitors were very open with me and my friends because we were cool. Our high school janitors were constantly high. And they would tell us about it. It was like, I just went out to the shed. I'm just so baked right now. Like, good. Make your movie janitor super baked. And then he's not paying attention. Then you can still do your Spider-Man fight behind the janitor. It's just more realistic this way.
How old were your janitors?
Yeah.
Adult-sized, adult-aged. Yeah.
Yeah? Like in their 50s?
No.
My janitors were always, like, elderly guys.
Oh, I think, like, 30s and 40s.
Oh, okay. So pretty chill.
Chill janitors. Mm-hmm.
They were cool then?
Yeah, they were real cool.
Okay.
Dan, you wrote an article a while back about...
Had to have been a while back.
About the jobs that men and women are allowed to have in movies.
Boys are architects.
Boys are architects, and women have three jobs. One of three jobs.
Bakers, something, 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 TV.
Writers, journalists?
So, yeah, something vaguely related to journalism, mm-hmm. Knocked Up, Katherine Heigl, The Ugly Truth, Morning Glory, State of Play.
Never Been Kissed.
Rachel McAdams in everything, I guess. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Definitely Maybe. You included Tara Reid and Van Wilder, which, all right.
Bridget Jones.
Two, shrewd to the point of being unhappy businesswoman, which you can tell because she's wearing a pantsuit.
Mm-hmm.
Devil Wears Prada, Everybody's Fine, The Family Stone. And then founder and often sole employee of a cute specialty shop, mostly bakeries.
Oh, yeah, the boutique shop. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got mail, waitress, chocolat, Stranger Than Fiction, It's Complicated, The Muse, The Perfect Man, and then, like, Bridesmaids, which upset all tropes of romantic comedies. She was still, like, a baker.
Yeah.
They didn't even really make fun of it, did they?
No, it wasn't played for laughs. It was just the only way that they ever even utilized it was that she made a cupcake for one.
Yeah,
right.
And like her and Chris O'Dowd had some, like, he bought her a bunch of baking things, and she was unhappy about that for some reason that escapes me now. But yeah, they're very, very specific jobs that are allowed in movies that I guess just do work, so we don't have to spend too much time explaining what a person's like. Like writers, I think, really like men to be architects because, well, I can't make the main character a writer, because then everyone's going to think I'm talking about me. So let's make him an architect. Architect is, like, kind of like a writer. It's like, that's still, like, always, like, a dreamer of some kind. He's got a creative side, and he goes to work and does, like, creative things when... That's the other thing, is almost none of the movie architects that get represented are in any way realistic to what modern architecture is, because, like, we're good on buildings. Ted Mosby, you're not making six buildings for the New York fucking skyline in 10 years on How I Met Your Mother. They're all of the architects I know...
Work in China for the most part.
Have very specific jobs that aren't purely designing buildings.
There's no Andrew Lloyd Wrights left in the world.
No, no. Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah.
Andrew Lloyd Webber.
There aren't any of those either.
But I think Andrew Lloyd Webber would be one who's left in the world. But
architect is a job that writers feel like I can write about being an architect without having to do any research into what that's like. Everyone knows.
Because it has a shorthand, which is they sit at a drafting table with something that vaguely looks like a blueprint on it and, like, one of those big rulers. And that just means architect.
And there's a base salary that you know you're working from that makes them achievable in the movie, like, makes them a good catch.
artistic.
That you learned probably in the game of life, I assume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're seeing more people who work at greeting card companies in movies than I thought. Like Joaquin Phoenix and Her has some kind of greeting card business of the future, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt in 500 Days of Summer is an architect who works at a greeting card company. I don't know. I think that's, again, the same thing where a writer is like, we need to show that he has a creative side. And we assume that greeting cards employ 300 people.
Well, it's a great way
constantly working
in Act 3 to produce a card for somebody that means an awful lot. I think that's only set up that they use that over and over.
And in both cases, the people are like vaguely dissatisfied with their work. It's like, this is a cute way to be a dissatisfied writer.
Yeah.
That's not just being a dissatisfied writer.
Yeah.
Not cute.
And it's rare for them to acknowledge Josh is an architect. His girl that he likes... also an architect. Like, they would never do that because they were like, no, the boy is an architect. She has a different job.
Yeah.
No one meets at work and then likes each other.
She has a softer job.
Yeah.
So I want to see a guy with a boutique cupcake shop.
I love that.
Hell yeah.
There's another job that really drives me crazy in movies that some may call the hardest job in the world. The way that dads are represented in movies is amazing. The bar is so low for what it means to be a dad in both movies and television that it's borderline insulting. And I don't think that that's just a product of, oh, dads are hapless and stupid. I think it's a product of everyone expects an awful lot of moms. And so dads just get like this free pass. Even the movie... Bad Moms. Did you guys see that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the dads in that are terrible. I mean, they're so, so bad. And while it would be easy to point to that and be like, look, men have to deal with this all the time. No, that's actually a product of the way that we expect women to be very, very good with kids right from the start. Yeah. And we don't have that expectation of men at all. And we can just laugh at them instead.
What about the hot dad? The hot dad is
the hot dad's the only one who knows what he's doing.
Right. Yeah.
Bad Moms, rare exception where a female protagonist walks in on husband cheating, doing weird sex stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I actually didn't hate that movie. I thought it was pretty good.
Catherine Hahn has my goddamn number. Everything she does is perfect. I think she's incredible in that movie.
It's a really weird, it's a strange movie. She's very good in it. It translates into the real world. I think it came from movies originally and came from TV and commercials and things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the hapless dad who doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. If you pick up a book that's like What to Expect When You're Expecting or a book Once Your Child's Already Born, it has like a section for dads. It's
written
so condescending.
In big type with like lots of pictures and like diagrams.
It's got a chapter and it's so condescending about like, all right, you can't be physical with your kid until they're probably at least 4 months old. Yeah. You can't throw them up in the air. And
the bottle goes in the mouth. Diapers on the butt. Yeah. Get it through your head.
No hot dogs. I'm going to remind you again at the end of the chapter. Because I know you're going to forget because there's like four pages in this chapter.
That is true. They have like especially in like Knocked Up and stuff where like the dad has like a moment of like, I'm a good dad now. It's just like he like read...
a story,
books.
Yeah.
He, like, just read the books that she already read. That's a good thing. I'm not saying don't do that. It's just, like...
that's the bar in the movie, is that he read some books she gave him.
They also, and Jack and Soren, you can speak to how wrong this is, but the other part of the bar for movie dads is read the books when the baby is born and start doing baby stuff then. There's no action, no awareness that you need to have while your wife is pregnant.
Right, yeah.
Because she's going to... she with does all that stuff.
Right.
And then as long as you know how to like hold the baby when it's born, fine.
Pregnancy is long. There's plenty of time to prepare stuff.
Yeah. Like this. Well, there's all kinds of shit that you should know while they're pregnant too. Like things that could go seriously wrong or that you should be prepared for. But they don't account for any of that. But that's the women's work to like incubate.
To
and then
be
once
aware.
Once the child is born, your job is to, sometimes you read to it at night and then that means you're a good dad.
I wonder how much of it is generational, like that a lot of these tropes got sort of set in concrete at a time when sort of gender roles were changing. And these were writers who had grown up in households where dads worked and were somewhat clueless about like what to do around the house. And so they knew that the roles were changing, but they'd never seen a dad who like had done those things. Yeah. So they were like, man, my dad would be fucking hopeless if he like had to change a diaper. And so like we're seeing basically what they think 1940s dads would look like if they were forced into these roles.
Right. I feel like if they really thought about it, anyone who's written that diaper scene, like, oh, my dad could never change my diaper. Wait, hang on a second. There were probably stretches of time where it was just you and your dad. Like, fully raised you for a while.
We're still on the dad's side, even when, like, the kid shows up at the park and has socks over his shoes, or like he's clearly has no clothes on, or like is fucked up in some really, really noticeable way. But you're like, but he's trying. The dad's really putting in the effort in.
Also, like, dude, you dress yourself.
You know how clothes go, man. Boots on the head, right? Boot goes on head. We wrote a long time ago about this amazing idea called the Bechdel test, about how it's still surprisingly rare for women to have a scene where two female characters speak to each other about something that's not a man. And we linked off to this source that is a professional screenwriter talking about how this was actually instruction that she received when she was in film school to not write a lot of scenes for two female characters talking about things that weren't men, because they explicitly were like, you need to have this straight white male protagonist. Everything needs to kind of revolve around them because that's just what they want to see. And like, you hear it all the time in those Sony leak emails. I always go back to the fact that there's a guy who was like, hey, Denzel Washington is my favorite actor, you guys. He's my favorite actor, but we can't have a sequel to The Equalizer because black doesn't travel. And people in foreign countries won't go see a movie with a black protagonist. I'm just saying what's the truth. That's not how I feel. And like, that's what she said. She said that she couldn't understand why people kept coming back and being like, let's cut this scene where they're not talking about the protagonist. And someone finally was just like, the audience doesn't want to listen to a bunch of women talking about whatever it is women talk about. And then they were like, I mean, that's not how I see it. That's how they see it.
I believe that. I actually got weird advice when I first moved out. I met with a manager who told me that nobody wants a girl in the writer's room. And he ended it with, I don't make the rules.
Yeah.
What? It's like,
and Christian Bale a couple of years ago, like when he did that Moses movie, he was like, look, I agree it's fucked up, but people won't go see a Moses movie if there's not a white guy in it. I don't know. I haven't been given the option.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Anyways, I mean, that's a very hateful example.
Yeah, it was crazy. And then after that, like, it was like on a smaller scale, things like that would happen. Like, I had one person who was like working in development who was just like, nobody wants a female lead. Sorry. It was like years ago. They were like, nobody's going to watch a female lead. And then, of course, like Jessica Jones comes out and like all this other stuff. And so I'm just like, clearly wrong. You just haven't been giving people the opportunity.
Right. What was this manager's like? Hey, it's great. Really, really big fan. Nobody wants a woman in a writer's room. And you're like, all right, back to Minnesota.
It was pretty heartbreaking.
That's the end of my career then.
Yeah, it was pretty heartbreaking. It was just very much like him being like, I don't make the rules. I'm sorry.
Right.
And I was like, you enforce them.
I'm wondering if this is also just how tropes work, that like they feel like, well, because this has been done before, this is just the way it has to be. Like, so these things that seem like somewhat arbitrary, but they keep happening over and over again because Hollywood's a city of cowards. Well,
it's an easy way to get from one point to another, right? An audience already understands.
Yeah.
But I go back to the idea of kissing on a doorstep. Did we invent that? Was that something that happened in culture before it happened in movies, or were movies the first place that happened and then everyone just assumed that's what people do? Because kissing on it's such a specific thing that we just take for granted, that at the end of a date you kiss on the doorstep.
It's the only place I kiss.
he's like Pretty Woman, not on the mouth, only on the doorstep.
I love that idea of somebody in a car. You're like in a car with somebody, they're like, well, good night. And you're like, no, we gotta go to the doorstep.
We gotta go up the little steps. Oh, there's no steps. I live in an apartment. Hey, it was good meeting you.
Yeah.
It was gonna work out.
So it's weird to think which affected which. And yeah, I think a lot of times there is a shorthand that you can create in movies that then accidentally becomes part of the culture.
Like the first person who in real life said, to get over a breakup, you need to go out and like get yourself some strange. Yeah. I wonder how many, like that I can acknowledge. That's a movie thing. That's not real life. But I wonder if I did like a self audit, how much of my personality is just a series of movie and TV show clips of
a lot. I mean,
probably most of it.
Think about any time you've had
yours. Yeah, a lot.
Like semi-traumatic happened out of the ordinary. Somebody dies, or you find out that there was a natural disaster, or something, there's an emergency in your life. like how immediately your mind goes to how people react to that kind of thing in a movie.
Yeah.
And whether you want it to or not. And whatever you do feels very disingenuous because it's like, well, I don't know if I just took this, if I just cribbed this from movies or not.
Yeah.
We are just walking movie tropes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've said it before and I'll say it again. We really just rely on when we're asking ourselves, how do people think the real world exists? We don't go to the news. We don't go to history books or something. We go to what they've seen in movies.
Yeah. Right.
And that serves us better than anything else when we're writing articles, because they're giving us the most vivid sort of visualizations of these things that we'll ever see. And we're visual creatures, so they stick in our mind better. And that's what we build our model of reality out of. All right, that's it for this week's episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Before we go, one more harmful example I didn't have time to get to is how movies portray people with disabilities, like all of them. Blindness, deafness, para and quadriplegics. Doesn't matter. In movies, anything is better than living with a disability. Up to and sometimes including death. Like in Scent of a Woman, Al Pacino shouts, "I'm in the dark here," in a Cajun accent for some reason, to explain why he's planning to commit suicide. Even though up to that point, he's like a fun guy who squeezes every last drop of juice out of life, but, you know, can't see, so fuck it. Million Dollar Baby literally suggests that killing Hillary Swank is the humane thing to do, not killing Hillary Swank, but her character. Just killing her is more humane than letting her live out her days as a quadriplegic with a low-class family. To which quadriplegics were probably like, nah, we're good. We're fine over here. There's actually a great anecdote where Eliza Dushku's character on Dollhouse was blind for an episode, and to prepare for the performance, she spent a couple days with a blind woman to get a sense of how she moved through the world. And when it came time to shoot the episode, they actually had to stop production and recalibrate her entire performance because, according to the producers, she didn't look, quote, blind enough. She was doing an impression of how actual blind people live and move through the world and not, you know, movie blind people. The producers were like, nah, bro, you need to be like feeling your way along the wall and constantly shouting, "Who turned the lights out?" And this is actually a common complaint. Paraplegics have told us on the site that I think in Avatar, the main character getting in and out of his chair made it look way harder than it actually is. It's something that they have to do every day. And he, you know, milked it like he was being scored on a gymnastics pommel horse routine. Anyways, that's just the last one. That's kind of a pet peeve of mine. Hey, knock it off, movies. On to some brief footnotes. We're going to link off to a live episode that we did on a similar subject called Dumb Movie Tropes That Need to Die. We're going to link off to a video about bizarrely specific scenes Hollywood won't quit using. That's the episode of OPCD that sparked this episode. We'll link off to a video, my video, movie straw man characters that keep showing up, and a video, bizarrely specific ways movies get normal jobs wrong. Then a bunch of articles, bizarrely specific rules that exist in movie universes, bizarrely specific job trends in movies, and products that only exist in movies. An old column by Daniel O'Brien. And finally, we have three different image galleries about movie tropes. And finally, we'll link off to that New Yorker article, What Did Jesus Do?, where Adam Gopnik talks about actual logic versus narrative logic. Oh, and also The Hathor Legacy, which is that screenwriter talking about why film school literally intentionally taught her to write movies that don't pass the Bechdel test. So check those things out. And yeah, hope you enjoyed it. That's going to do it for this week. Thanks to engineer Brett, who you can follow at Brett R-A-D-E-R on Twitter. You can follow me at Jack_OBRIEN. And we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you guys then. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Scott.
Have you ever heard of a tripod?
What are you talking about?
Oh, whoa. Okay.
I'm sorry. I came in a little hot on
that. Yeah, that was...
I apologize.
This is a big podcast awareness campaign happening throughout March.
Now, I know about podcasts, and I know doing a podcast myself, I know a lot of people, they don't know what they are.
They don't even know what it is. So what we want people to do is to share your favorite podcast. It doesn't have to be ours. In fact, I would hate it if you shared mine.
You know what? I forbid you to share mine.
Exactly.
Let's say you know someone in your life who would probably enjoy a podcast if only they try it.
Right.
You could recommend a podcast that you think that person would like.
A lot of people, you know, listen to podcasts while they're working out. It takes their mind off of it. While they're working, it takes their mind off.
While they're doing laundry.
While they're driving.
Some people like to watch that video of a fox decomposing and listen to a podcast at the same time.
If you're one of these people, then you must know someone like that who would really enjoy podcasts, but they still don't really understand what they are or why they're special.
You could tell your friends how easy it is to listen to podcasts. There's maybe two steps to it. It's very simple.
Or send them to trypodcasts.org.
I didn't know there was a website. Why are we even talking about this?
They should just be going to the website. Why are they listening to us?
We should have just sent people to the website.
Tell us what show you recommended with the hashtag tripod, TRYPOD.
And you're a daisy if you do.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.